This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
If you've spent any length of time in hospital, either as a patient or maybe looking after a loved one, you just want to get home. Hospitals feel so foreign, you know, 24 hours of noise making it impossible to sleep. The food is generally terrible. You may have no natural light, no fresh air. The smell is clinical and the walls are bare. But it turns out the room that you stay in, it does actually impact your recovery, both emotionally and physically. And with two new hospitals opening this year, a nicer environment is been taken seriously. So what has helped you when you've had a hospital stay? From the food to the walls to the fresh air to be able to see outside. And were you able to sleep? And also this hour, it's Friday, so Jacinta Parsons, as always, joins me. And today we are talking about the never-ending hell of having to cook dinner every night. As a man, as a woman, who signed up for this? And we'll also talk about the love of an early dinner. How early is too early?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So if you have spent time in hospital, you know it's grueling. Not only are you trying to recover from the operation that brought you there in the first place, chances are you're not sleeping due to 24-hour noise in a hospital setting. In some cases, in intensive care, you may have no idea what day it is, whether it's day or night, because there's no natural light. Not to mention the feeling of never having any fresh air. Well, that is all about to change, because the way we design our hospitals, it's been in the news a little bit over the last couple of weeks, given that we've redeveloped Frankston and Footscray Hospital. We've moved Footscray Hospital, built a whole new one, and natural light and soundproof rooms have all been factored in. And that's because it helps not just with our well-being, but with our recovery. So what has your hospital experience been like? 1-300-222-774. You can text 0437-774-774. Julie Willis is a professor of architecture at Melbourne University and has looked into hospital design extensively. Julie, once the idea of hospital design was, should we put a brightly coloured painting on the walls and should we try and, you know, brighten up the place a little bit? But now we're looking at anything and everything from fresh air to soundproofing rooms. This is a huge step forward.
It is, and it's really good to see that architects and administrators are paying attention to the well-being of patients, but also staff in hospital environments. It makes a really big difference to you as to whether when you're a patient and you're feeling very vulnerable, to be able to feel as though you have some control over your environment, to feel as though you can participate in a sort of more normal way of living, that is, that you can see things going on outside, that you can get a good night's sleep, and that you can have some control about where you are in the hospital. And so you can get outside to have a bit of fresh air or a bit of sunshine.
It makes a huge difference, doesn't it? Just knowing sometimes where you are and what time it is. For example, I was reading about a man who'd spent a lot of time in intensive care and there was no natural light and he had no idea whether it was day or night. And he asked his partner to bring in a clock so that he at least had time to gauge, because if you did fall asleep, you didn't know how long you'd been asleep for, and you'd wake up and you wouldn't really know whether you're up or down, Arthur or Martha. The idea of bringing that normality in, how is it being factored into hospitals now? What are they doing?
Well, they're thinking very much about how patients can have more autonomy. And so that sense of connectedness to outside, the inclusion of much more, availability of windows, and to think about where the patient can be at different times. So can they actually move around the hospital rather than being contained in a room or a bed? And it improves everything for the patient when they can do that. So it has a lot of design challenges. Hospitals are really complex environments that have lots of planning issues. They have equipment issues. Mm. And particularly post-COVID, there's more attention on to the way air is managed throughout a hospital. So it's a really big design challenge to do this, but architects are managing to create some really beautiful environments in hospitals these days.
Julie Willis is with you, Professor of Architecture at Melbourne University. We're looking at the future of hospital design and what we factor in into the environment to ensure that our stay is, well, as enjoyable as it can be under the circumstances. But to help with both our emotional recovery and our physical recovery, you mentioned sleep, Julie. Sleep is almost impossible in a hospital setting, even if you're there to look after someone. You know, you're on a chair, you're sort of sitting up, or if you're in the hospital yourself, hospitals, and rightly so, run 24 hours. And I was reading that there are some rooms at the new Footscray Hospital that are soundproof. I mean, there's a text here that says, I just did a stint at St Vincent's back in December. I could hear the full conversation between the patients and the doctors in the rooms next to me. How important is it to sleep?
Well, sleep is essential for recovery. I'm not a doctor, so I have to be careful about what I say here. But we all know that good night's sleep makes us more resilient and able to face whatever comes the next day. So personally, I think that being able to give patients a better night's sleep must have a positive benefit for them. But it's the same in engaging in just getting some sunshine. We know the positive benefits of vitamin D and the production of that through exposure to sunshine. So being able to access some sunshine is really important too. And I will say, across history, some of these things have been seen as really important in the past. When there weren't drugs like penicillin and ways of treating people through drug therapies, both doctors and architects had to rely on the physical environment more to create spaces that were supportive for therapy and healing.
Oh, right, like sunshine.
Absolutely like sunshine.
Yeah.
So if you go and have a look at hospitals designed in the 1930s, they have great big balconies so the bedbound patients could be wheeled out on them to get enough sunshine to help them. So it was a treatment for skin disease, for tuberculosis, and of course it made people feel better.
Wow.
But once things like Sabin vaccine came in for polio and penicillin came in to treat things like tuberculosis, it wasn't seen as important in hospitals anymore to have those balconies. And so the hospital sort of closed up the systems and we lost all of those well-being aspects to the hospital design. And so what we're actually seeing now is a kind of return to ideas that were coming out in the 1920s and 1930s.
There's so many texts just saying, who would have thought fresh air and sunshine? I'm so glad that this is being elevated to being seen as essential. I want to get through some of the texts. Julie, stay with us because Steph's in Edith Vale. Morning, Steph. Oh, it'll be beautiful down there this morning, Steph.
Oh, no complaints here. It's gorgeous.
I could imagine.
I'd just like to see how we're going with chemical use in hospitals. For instance, I've got environmental illness, multiple chemical sensitivities. So going into hospitals for me actually makes me sicker. Some hospitals overseas are now realising that for people to work there, they have to go in without perfumes and not use perfume laundry powders. Like some doctors now, and all staff in a hospital, for instance, I think it was in Spain. No, I think it was Canada. They actually have to sign an agreement saying they won't be perfumed when they go to work. So it's safer for the patients who get migraine or asthma or who are chemical sensitive. And it just means that the people are breathing fresh, all the patients are breathing fresh air, so they're healing better anyhow. So are we getting closer to that here?
That's a great observation, Steph. What do you think, Julie? Are we getting closer to that here?
I'm not really expert in this area, but certainly the way in which air handling is managed in hospitals, they have to think about this very carefully, and they have to think about the amount of fresh air that's brought in and circulated. But remember also there's this sense that airborne particles, of course, can mean that a transmission of disease. So everything is very carefully thought about in terms of air handling, and of course in the way materials are specified to ensure that they can be clean and cleanable to reduce the impact on patients and any sort of acquired things that may adversely affect them while they're in hospital.
And given that there's already going to be a lot of smells, we all know that hospital smell, and then you add another level of fragrance or just some really strong deodorant to that as well. Good on you, Steph. Thank you. I've lost track of the amount of texts coming in saying things like this. Hey there, I had two stays in hospital following surgery in the last 12 months. The biggest issue is the ability to be able to see out a window. The first stay I was very unwell, but I could gaze across the Metropolitan, sixth floor, and I could see the bay. It made all of the difference. The second stay, different hospital, I gazed all day at a gum tree in the courtyard. Sun is so important. And Jen in Torquay says, my one and only overnight stay in hospital was all of the things you've just said. My sanity was kept by eye-spying a palm tree outside a little window high up near the ceiling in my room. I imagined I was on a tropical island, so far from the reality of where I actually was. The advances in how this work I just think is incredible. I want to have a chat to Malcolm, who's in Healesville as well. Hi, Malcolm.
Hello, how you going?
Really well. What was your experience like?
Well, in April, I went into Peter Mac for prostate surgery, and I awoke at about 8 o'clock, and I was in a small cubicle. And when the nurse came in, I asked him if he could leave the curtain open because it was stuffy, and he did that. And then he went over and looked in the room across the hall and said, "I can do even better," because there was no one in the room opposite me. He opened their curtains as well, and I had a beautiful view of the city.
Oh, nice. Gosh, that makes a difference. How did that change your time there, Malcolm?
Look, I didn't sleep for 24 hours, and it just made it relaxed and made me feel comfortable.
How are you now, Malcolm?
Oh, perfect. Back at work. Better than before.
Good, good. It makes that big difference, and you did mention, Julie, I mean, that was great of that staff member to say to Malcolm, "I can do one better than that, and I can actually open, there's no one here, we can open another door and another window." But the impacts of these changes, these architectural changes and design changes for staff, we may spend time in hospital for a short or a medium period, but there are staff that spend years in there.
And it's really important that they have excellent spaces. It's quite easy to put lots of emphasis on the patients and to forget about the staff. But the staff are there a lot, and they see some really difficult things. So they need places of rest and repose and to be able to retreat. I did get a tour of the new Peninsula University Hospital down in Frankston recently, and it was fantastic to see that the staff spaces, where all the meeting rooms were, there was an adjacent balcony, and so that the meeting could be held either on the balcony or it could be held in the closed space, but there was always a point in which a staff member could get outside to just decompress for a few minutes, get that fresh air, listen to the birds, And it was really nice to see the thought that had been put into their staff spaces.
Be able to take that moment so that they can go back in and do it all again. I hate to raise and throw the grenade in right at the end here, but to talk about food, how food in hospital can impact our stay. I know most of us have probably snuck food in for a loved one that's had a long stay in hospital. That's changing. I mean, I got a text straight away saying the food at the Bairnsdale Hospital is fantastic. But then this one from Diana that says, oh, Rish, when my dad was sick, the food he was given was no way nutritious or giving his body any support for his immune system. I was so upset. I spoke with the nurses about it, but it's not their fault. It was just so depressing. This needs to change. And that's just an example of one too many. That loss, and we're going to be talking about food and the idea that you have to cook dinner every night. And as much as we hate it most of the time, you have choice. You eat what your body feels like or what you feel like your body needs. Food in hospitals, and this is probably an entire conversation for another day, how important is that in our recovery?
Well, as I said, I'm not a doctor, so I'm not really expert in this area. But I do know that through time, there's been enormous emphasis on how food is managed for patients. And I'm thinking right back over history here. Many years ago, it used to be the province of the nurses to create the food for patients. But it became sort of professionalised, and there's often a lot of scientific engagement in the nutrition that is brought to the tray, to the table for the patient. And they're huge industrial kitchens. You have to imagine just how many people are being fed the right food at the right time. It has a tendency, a bit like airline food, to get to a lowest common denominator very quickly. And it's an expensive part of the operation. So I'm sure there are times that they don't get it right. But I know from a design point of view, this is a huge logistical operation that's pretty difficult to get right all of the time.
I secretly really like those little trays of sandwiches that they have, though. It's a secret shame of mine. I know. I'm sure if I was there for any long period of time, I'd hate them. But, oh, the way they're packaged and cut into little triangles and white bread and all the things I wouldn't normally eat. Julie, really good to get your thoughts on this. Thank you so much for your insights. Julie Willis, Professor of Architecture at Melbourne University. Kathy's in Port Melbourne. Morning.
Hi, morning.
What did you want to share?
I was just going to say, I once spent 10 weeks in hospital in Hong Kong.
Wow.
I didn't know I was going to be that long, but I remember I was on a shared ward and requesting the bed next to the window because it looked over the water. But nobody else wanted that bed because it also looked over a cemetery, and that was considered bad luck for the locals. But I just was so glad I wasn't in the middle bed with no outlook at all.
Yeah, it's a long time to be in hospital, Kathy. Wow.
Yeah. But also I didn't eat a single meal the whole 10 weeks because the food was terrible.
Was it? I thought you were going to say that maybe the food was better. You were getting some great noodles and stir fries.
No, it was terrible. So I managed to have people bring me in food for those whole 10 weeks, which was a game changer as well. That would have made the stay a lot different.
You're okay now, Kathy?
Yeah, I was fine. It was a problem with the pregnancy, so I had to be on bed rest.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Lots of people talking about pregnancy too and being in shared rooms and, you know, the noise and especially...
The noise is women drying their hair at 10:30 at night.
Yeah.
The noise level was different.
Yeah, depending on how your birth's gone, right? Some of us can't move and others are, you know, bopping around and having a little dance like nothing's happened. Kathy, thank you. Gosh, so many texts on this, and this is interesting, and we might follow this up. It says, please, 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 please do a program on perfumes and the increasing number of people who get anaphylaxis or are just intolerant. It's an extremely divisive topic, but it might need to be highlighted. I think we might actually look into that. So that's a great idea. Still coming up with Jacinta Parsons in about 10 minutes' time, cooking dinner every night. Are you over it? Do you know what to do? Do people appreciate it? How much time do you dedicate to thinking about what to cook for dinner? That's coming up in just a moment as well.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So when the Beatles broke up, the world pretty much stopped, right? People cried and wailed in the street. Fans didn't know what to do next. But what about the actual Beatles? What was next for the Beatles? Well, Paul McCartney, there is a new documentary called Man on the Run, and it's all about how Paul rebuilt his life after the Beatles. Dan Condon, music editor at Double J. Gosh, we love a music documentary at the moment, Dan, don't we?
Look, absolutely. I mean, we love a Beatles movie at the moment, don't we?
Absolutely. So let's go to Paul. The idea of what to do next. What did he do next? The Beatles broke up. I mean, what's that next step? What do you do? What's your plan?
Well, yeah, I mean, and a lot of people would say, and they wouldn't be wrong, what he did next was he started Wings with his wife Linda, and they went on and had quite a successful career. All absolutely correct. But as we see in this documentary, it wasn't quite that straightforward. Immediately after the breakup, he went to this farmhouse that he owned, this really dilapidated farmhouse in Western Scotland, and basically stayed there, made his solo album. Him and Linda and their daughters were there basically just figuring out what to do. And that's where they made the Ram album and they formed Wings, the band. But basically he kind of ran away, and that is really covered strongly in the first part of this documentary, which has just come out.
So how did fans react? You know, what were they saying at the time? Was there much commentary on, you know, where he went? Was he running away? What was he doing? You know, is it up to scratch? Because there was a bit of pushback around Wings. I mean, who was ever going to live up to the Beatles, right? But how did people react to that next stage of his life at the time?
Look, I'm a big Beatles fan, and to be honest, I wasn't alive at the time that they split up, so I wasn't a part of this. But to me, and maybe this is unfair, it seemed like people reacted just in a really crazy way. It's not a very nice way to say it, but people were going mad. Mm. There was a prevailing thought that Paul McCartney was dead, and this was not just like a funny rumor. This was, people legitimately thought that he was dead.
Really?
The source also covered in the documentary was a tabloid photographer went all the way out to this west of Scotland and found Paul and Linda and took some photos, and so there was proof of life. So I mean, that just goes to show, I don't know what it would be like when you're the most popular musician in the world and then everyone's convinced that you're dead. It's just a really, really strange thing. In terms of musically, people really hated what Paul McCartney did after the Beatles, to be honest. His first album, just called McCartney, which is not bad, I have to be honest, but it just wasn't, it wasn't what people wanted. And even the early Wings records were absolutely slammed by critics. And look, fans were divided. I think a lot of people would have loved anything that Paul McCartney did at that time, but it wasn't that kind of home run that the Beatles had enjoyed for their kind of the entirety of their, albeit quite short, career.
And given, even just looking at some of the song length today of Wings tracks versus the Beatles, Beatles was short, you know, 2.5 minutes, you know, 3 max. A lot of the Wings tracks are sort of 5.5+ minutes, sounded very different. But I read this wonderful line where it was talking about sort of putting Wings together and how that band worked as a group. It said that, you know, given that he grew up in Liverpool, bosses in Liverpool were sort of viewed upon with suspicion, and he hated the idea of being in charge. I wonder whether he sort of just enjoyed the process of being in Wings and how different the band makeup of Wings was to the Beatles.
It's one of the most interesting things about this doco is this push and pull of the dynamic of Wings. Paul McCartney always, he was quite convinced in the documentary that they got it right in the end, but I'm not so convinced, because Wings kind of split up in fairly acrimonious circumstances in the early 80s. So I think the fact is that Paul McCartney wanted to be in a rock band with his mates, and he wanted to travel around and make music and do great stuff. And all of that did happen, but this whole time he was Paul McCartney. He wasn't just a normal guy like you or me. he was Paul McCartney. Mm. He was the biggest musician, not just in the world, but probably the biggest musician in history at that point. You can't just be another garage band when you're Paul McCartney. It's just not possible. There's a weight of expectation on your output, not to mention this thing hanging over you, the Beatles. When are they going to get back together? Which was the question that was asked in every
single
interview.
Stop mucking around with this other band, you know?
Exactly.
Just get back together.
So, you go.
No, I was just going to say, so generally because there are so many docos at the moment, and they often now, they're not these broad sweeping beginning, middle and end, let's try and put the entire life into a 2.5 hour series. They are a moment in time. Is it a good one? Like, is this a good period? Is this a good music documentary, do you think, Dan?
It's an interesting question, a very good question, because I will admit I am not a fan of this era of Paul McCartney. I don't really like Wings. I don't really like these records all that much. But this documentary is so effective because it just focuses on this time. I mean, we really don't see much before 1970. We don't see much post-1980, which allows Morgan Neville, the director, to really concentrate on just that 10-year period. And it was a big period. There was a lot going on. And those records did end up being very successful. And I am happy to be in the minority as not a huge fan. But even as someone who never really loved Wings, I found this to be really fascinating. I'm a huge Beatles fan. And the kind of it did add an extra layer of context into the dynamic of the band, their breakup and kind of everything that happened in the 70s. So yeah. I do think that
I'm interested.
Is
absolutely.
Really effective.
And
yeah.
Was just quickly, because got to move on, but was Paul involved? Like, I'm presuming he was heavily involved in the making of this. Yeah, great.
Yeah, I think that's an important point to make, is that a lot of these documentaries, when there's such heavy involvement from the artist,
they're different.
Look, he doesn't get away with everything. I mean, there's some honest and some difficult moments in there for him, for sure. But yeah, I mean, his fingerprints are all over it. He also has a book coming out soon, which will cover similar themes. So, look, take all that with a grain of salt, of course. But look, it is in terms of music doco, I think it's really effective and worth a look.
Thanks so much. Always good to chat, Dan. Dan Condon, great. Music editor at Double J. That documentary on Paul McCartney, it's called Man on the Run, How Paul McCartney Rebuilt His Life After the Beatles. So it's currently about 2 a.m. in the UK, but at 10 a.m. London time this morning, no doubt you would have seen and would have heard the dramatic scenes with swarms of police cars that arrived at the residence of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. He lived in Sandringham, and it has been 400 years since a royal was arrested. So how did it unfold, and how is it continuing to unfold? Juliet Reardon is an ABC royal commentator and author. Juliet, I know it's sort of about 2, 3am in the UK at the moment, but what's next? What will the day bring for those who are in the UK?
Well, Andrew is back at home now. He was arrested. He was taken to a police station. He was kept for several hours whilst the police looked into his home there in Sandringham, and also his former home in Windsor, Royal Lodge. They were gathering evidence because he was arrested on suspicion of misconduct in public office. Now, this is all to do with those emails that have been released in the Epstein files that have suggested that Prince Andrew passed on, he was Prince Andrew then, passed on confidential files and contacts to his good friend, sex offender, Jeffrey Epstein. This was whilst he was a trade envoy for the UK government. And obviously, this is a grave offence. Those were confidential files. That hasn't been verified yet. That's what this particular arrest is about. And that is what the police are trying to find out. They have spoken to him. He has been released. And the investigation is ongoing.
I could imagine there would just be not only swarms of police cars like we saw this morning, but swarms of reporters possibly heading from all around the world, staking out all key places, including his house of residence, including Buckingham Palace, you name it. We've seen the royals going about their everyday duties, trying to sort of, I guess, give the impression of business as usual. What do you predict? And I know this is a bit of a glass ball situation, but how do you predict the royals will go about their business today, Juliet?
Well, we've seen them, keeping calm and carrying on. But the day started really with a statement from His Majesty the King. He was pretty swift in releasing that statement, very quickly after Andrew was arrested. And it's worth pointing out that the King and Buckingham Palace and the royal household, they weren't given any advance warning of that arrest. So the King would have been as surprised by that as Andrew was, and as the British public and the rest of the world have been. So the King put out a statement, a very powerful statement, I thought. He said, I have learned with the deepest concern the news about Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. He didn't call him his brother.
No.
He was acting as a monarch there, not as a sibling, and the suspicion of misconduct in public office. What now follows is the full, fair and proper process by which this issue is investigated.
And given that it is, as we said, a very powerful statement, and given that it is very early in the morning, merely hours before people will wake and see not only what the headlines are on the tabloids, the newspapers, the magazines, their television channels, their radio stations, this is just the beginning. Juliet, thank you so much for your work around the clock since this is broken. We appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Juliet Reardon, ABC Royal commentator and author. Coming up next, Jacinta Parsons and I talk about the ongoing hell of cooking dinner every night of your life.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
My favourite time of the week. I don't know why I'm saying that.
Have you ever sung out of tune?
I got
that I had to go to the big boss's office to stop, be told to stop singing.
It
really hurts.
It did hurt.
They actually did.
I don't even know where that came from. Do you know why? In our house, we have this thing where we're feeling kind of annoyed and we want to insult somebody in our house, we sing it. So I think we sing pain and it lessens the blow a little bit. And given that we're talking about the pain of cooking dinner every night, if I sing it, maybe it's not as bad.
Oh, we've actually got a family song that's to do with dinner. Are you ready?
Do you swear?
No, okay. But there's two versions.
Yeah.
Chicken Parmigiana, chicken Parmigiana, chicken's Parmigiana, stick it in your chick Parmigiana. The other version is just chicken Parmigiana without the stick it in your chick.
Hang on. Are you making chicken Parmigiana for dinner?
No, but it's what we all want. But as if Mama's making that.
This is the thing.
That ain't happening.
So we've all felt it, but now publicly around the world, people are saying it. And you don't have to be the mum. You can be the dad. You can be the partner. There can be kids, no kids, small kids, large kids, whatever, friends.
Stupid kids.
Stupid kids. Stupid partners.
I've got some of them.
Stupid people wanting stupid dinner every stupid night of the week.
How? This is the most ridiculous part of being a human, is that there is a requirement for food all the time.
Do you know when I start thinking about dinner?
The day before.
When I'm eating dinner.
Yeah, because you've got to go and get the ingredients for the stupid dinner. It's got to be diverse enough across the week. I want you to know, and look in my eyes right now, I'm post-dinner. I have unleashed myself of actually being a good human and feeding my children well. And I can't.
Figure it out.
I'm done.
I want to say that this one, when my siblings and I were old enough to help ourselves to food, my mum would occasionally go on strike. I'm having a Vegemite sandwich. You can have what you want. No one starved. The roof didn't collapse. That's from Rosalind.
But do you have a lot of illness now? You know, I love that. Yeah, we survived it. But no, I do. Like, it is
It's relentless. And I don't even know how it became my job. And
yeah, how did it?
I actually like cooking dinner. So this.
And now you hate it.
Yeah. Yeah. I resent it.
The magic inside you got snuffed out.
And I get all antsy. You know, like when you aggressive clean?
You know, when you've sort of shoved a vacuum onto someone's
foot. You saute angrily.
I sit down and I'm like, how is it?
Imagine having to ask. Yeah. And you know what's really frustrating? You can cook it for an hour. It's gone in 5 minutes.
Yes.
The equation, it doesn't make any sense. Do you know that? Sorry, I'm quite emotional.
Let it out.
You know, you grow the kids, you feed them like diverse meals, right? So they built like a hatred for about 7 of my 8 meals. And so I'm like, am I the worst cook? We're talking risotto. We're talking dal. We're talking chicken pie. They rejected all of it. So I did this thing with Brian where every week I would bring in one of the meals that had been rejected by my children as just to sort of like eat it, give me something out of 10 for it. I was getting high marks. So what's going on with that as well?
Let's have a chat to Susanna in Mont Alban.
Oh,
hello, Susanna.
Michelle and Jacinta, I just want to thank you both for talking about this issue.
You're welcome.
Because we don't talk about it enough.
No.
And relentless is the correct word.
Yeah.
And I just have to share with you, we are going to a family funeral this afternoon. Now, the thing, though, is that this morning, you know what I've done?
I've gotten
dinner into the slow cooker.
Oh,
because you know what's going to happen? We're going to get home.
Dinner's
and
done.
And people are going to be looking at me, what's for dinner?
Yeah,
as
I know.
You know that I've not been at home cooking food for you, but they'll still be like...
And do you know what? You planned that 3 days ago. You worked out what you would have to do to get to the funeral and come back and feed everyone.
Correct.
Yes.
Do you hate yourself a little bit for it, Susanna?
Sorry, Rochelle, what did you say?
Do you hate yourself a little bit for it?
Oh, I'm actually pretty proud of myself for getting it in the slow cooker.
Like, no, I mean for, like, doing it, you know? Like, bugger them.
I don't think I've ever heard that on the ABC. Is that allowed to be said?
Too late.
Yeah, dump
it. You can say that.
I understand
what you're saying. I understand what you're saying, but honestly, I'm in a place of acceptance, I think, at this point where I'm just like, it's happening. Look, future me is going to be loving past me for getting it in the slow cooker.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Good on you.
I mean, I love you. You know what? Rochelle and I coming over for dinner, and the others can work themselves out.
Because the other thing is, too, I don't want to get home and have a terrible dinner either, because I don't want Vegemite toast for dinner every second night. We're not alone. I want to play you a little bit of a woman who I know we both follow online. I don't even know how she came into my feed.
Neither do I.
No, but she's great.
And I would send it to you. You were like, babe, I'm all over this.
So big time adulting or something. She's, I think, an American woman. She just bags out her kids, her husband, whatever, tells it how it is. And this is her reflection on cooking dinner.
Is everyone in my family seriously going to keep wanting dinner every day? I genuinely thought I was going to enjoy making dinner for my family because I genuinely like to cook. But nobody tells you about the soul-crushing task of deciding what's for dinner every day. Not to mention I should hold a vigil for all of the food that my kids have left out to die alone in the cold on their plates. And then I'm going to tell them that every day I think really hard about a healthy dinner idea that everybody will hopefully like. And then I go out and buy all the right ingredients in all the right quantities. And I prepare it and cook it at a time that hopefully coordinates with everybody's busy f***ing schedules. And then I start to pray that everybody will just sit the f*** down, shut the f*** up, and eat the fucking food without complaining so that I don't have to hand another piece of my soul over to the dinner devil for the love of mashed potatoes and gravy. Fucking dinner.
My soul. That's what's been taken. The devil,
dinner
devil.
Did you do those beeps, just by the way?
Yeah. It's hard to put those beeps in.
Because you know the feelings anyway.
That's it.
Yeah.
The dinner devil has taken our soul. And we don't even know where or how we signed up for this. Rochelle, Jacinta, a few thoughts on the so-called cooking dinner drudge. If you're in a family situation, children must learn to cook that it's not a chore. It's a part of sharing the household.
Oh, yes.
Age taken into consideration. When you're in the mode of, oh, not again, what am I going to cook for dinner? I give myself a good talking to. I'm lucky that I can actually cook dinner and that I have food to cook. Lucky us. That's from a food lover. That's from Chrissy in Hastings. I want to be that person.
Well, look. If we make it a relative concern, because of course eating food, thank goodness we can, then we take it to the next bit. Okay, we can cook food. Does it always have to be me doing that? Did I really answer that?
Yeah. No, that's all right. I want to have a chat to John, who's in Maidstone, because this is not a gendered thing, John.
No, it's a butler.
Yeah, I know.
Well, I cook for a living, but I also cook for everyone in my household every night. And I'm reminded of something my mother used to say, bringing up 3 sons on her own. And that was, you get what you get,
and you don't won't get upset. Yeah.
So, I mean, I always plan the evening meals ad hoc.
Because
I do all the cooking.
Are you ad hoc, my friend? That would stress me out so much.
I do all the cooking as well, so I always know what's in the fridge.
Oh, you do all the shopping. Got it.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I always have a backup in the freezer.
Oh.
So if I get home and I couldn't be stuffed, it's like out of the freezer, meat pie, there you go.
I do. The freezer is your friend, is a saying in our household.
Can I, both of you, listen to this cautionary tale?
Oh, what?
I used to pre-make sandwiches for my kids and put them in the freezer.
Too far.
One day I accidentally took the wrong lunch to school. It was the frozen sandwich. And I was like, this is actually
disgusting.
Abusive. Like, it is so bad. Like, it was so bad.
When my daughter was a bub, I pre-made, you know, when they had to eat squishy food? And so I pre-squished all this fruit. What I thought was fruit, and I put what I thought was pears on her Weet-Bix, and she wouldn't eat her Weet-Bix. And then, you know, because you don't make your own food, I'm scoffing her Weet-Bix that she wouldn't eat when I went to the sink, and I spat it out everywhere because I actually put mashed cauliflower. It's disgusting.
Wow.
She even had a few mouthfuls.
Did she?
Yeah.
Is she okay now?
Oh, no.
No.
We
trace that all back. All any issues that are happening are related to that.
I once had a friend say to me, and we are still friends, what's on your meal plan? And I remember going, huh? Meal plan. And now I sort of do meal plan. But when a friend used the term to me like it was fact,
Like, there's no question if you have it.
No.
It's like that you
what's
do.
What's on your meal plan?
What are you doing?
Yeah. And, my brain went, what is a meal plan? Not what is on your meal plan.
No.
You know what I mean? It's hope fear.
Hope and fear. And this is probably, again, like cleaning your room, this is where social structures of our minor lives, our micro living, come to fore. If you've made dinner 4 hours and someone's like, I don't really want it, do you know how much personal resentment you feel?
Do you want to just throw it sometimes?
Yeah.
Like pick it up,
you know,
of those dramatic scenes and chuck it into the sink?
I cared about the nutrients in this meal.
Yeah.
I cared about the flavour of this meal.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that you will survive a couple more years.
Yeah.
I've done that for you and there is no sense. But that actually then tears us apart.
I know. And then I become the person I don't want to be.
Oh, they made you that. Not
me.
It's not you. It ain't you.
Trish is in Macrae. Hi, Trish.
Hey, how you going?
How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I just wanted to say that two things. When my kids were little, critiquing my food, they could only say that they wouldn't like to have that meal again. We're allowed to say yuck, or that was horrible.
Very good.
And then when they became older teenagers, we cut a deal that I have got two kids that they cooked 1 week. One child cleaned up, the next child the next week, and me the next week. My husband was left out of that. Otherwise, you know, sorry, we would have got baked beans on toast. But, yeah, it worked really well.
Here's the thing. What's wrong with baked beans on toast?
Nothing.
I love baked beans.
High sugar content, but don't worry about that.
A little sugar, but there's lots of fibre.
No, sugar's really
too much sugar. I thought about eating baked beans for dinner last night because I was on my own.
You know you can do that.
I was worried about the sugar.
Don't worry about
that. I scrambled eggs.
Trish, I mean, did they deliver some good stuff early on?
Oh, amazing food.
Really?
And they're fantastic cooks now. They're in their
30s. I'm going to do this.
Yeah,
I'm going to do
it.
It's
a really good idea. Still, I still paid for all that food, but I didn't have to cook it.
You know, the other thing when it comes to food and cooking, Trish, thank you, is the time that we eat dinner. I'm finding that I'm ready for dinner, like 4 o'clock.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm so early. I'm like, is it too early?
There's something magical that happens to us as we age. It's beautiful. The desire to never leave your home starts to take over. Your desire to go to bed at 7 o'clock is present. And so therefore, everything moves back a little bit.
What time do you eat dinner?
Wow.
Yeah.
I reckon 5 o'clock.
Oh, yeah, I'm good with five.
Five is fantastic.
And it stops the snacking. I was reading this whole mum thing at one point. It can be a dad thing, whatever. But they had this idea of give your kids dinner at 4 o'clock because when they get home from school, they're like, 2 minute noodles, whatever. They're in the cupboard. And then dinner comes along and they're like, I'm not hungry. I don't want to eat. And you're like, the dinner devil comes out.
That's right. It's so true. I had something else in my little head about these wild little people that are in our lives.
Can I play you this?
Please do.
So Amy Poehler and Gwyneth Paltrow, they also love an early dinner.
Oh, good.
What time do you like to eat dinner? I like it at 6.
Okay, me too.
I make my reservations at 6 p.m.
So do I.
I love it so much.
So great.
And I honestly, sometimes I like to be the first person in the restaurant.
I was last night.
Mm-hmm.
I did 5:45 last night.
Incredible.
I know.
To be in bed and have eaten by 8 o'clock.
Oh, is there anything better?
No. No. I think about bedtime all day.
I think about bedtime as I'm getting out of bed, you know, and just, okay, how long have I got to, like, get back here?
That idea that they whisper.
And their American accents are, they're
but
something.
I think you do have to whisper. Like, even today, I felt like I had to whisper, I hate cooking.
This is everything. Everything has to move back. Mm. Gig times, times that we're watching television. Like, should be on at 4 o'clock, although that's when Antiques Roadshow is, so
alone. Some really good shows come on while I'm on air, and sometimes I have to pull myself away because I'm like, Rish, concentrate. You don't need to watch the massage chair. So I'm down with that massage chair.
I think everything's too late in our lives, full stop.
I'm not sure who we have on the line here. I think this is someone's dad. Whose dad do we have in Albert Park?
This is Mom's dad. Breakfast and Mon's dad.
Triple R. Hello, I love a bit of Mon.
Hello. Well, what's your dinner dilemma?
Well, for 20 years of my life, I spent probably 2 weeks a month travelling overseas on business, and my penance when I got back for the 2 weeks between trips was to cook dinner every night for my, at the time, three young children. And I had a repertoire, like JP said, of about 8 or 10 different meals, tiger and curry, spag bol, fantastic carbonara, et cetera. But look, one night I got home from Europe and I was absolutely knackered. And my kids came and woke me up and said, Dad, it's tea time. And I just couldn't be bothered cooking them anything off my 5-star gourmet menu. So I looked in the fridge and there was some Stras.
I'm leaning in, actually. Yeah, I'm coming over. Look,
I've got it on the menu tonight, actually. Ooh. It had the consistency of dried up linoleum, and I thought, if I put it in the microwave, it'll freshen it up. So I put half a dozen slices in it, and they curled up to form a little bowl.
Oh.
And at the bottom of the bowl, there was the grease that had melted.
Oh.
And I thought, I better give them some vegetables because my wife said make sure they had vegetables.
Were
so
you
I found,
literally just going to give them Stras rolled up into a ball?
I could have done that. And I found some potato gems.
Boom.
It takes too long to put them in the oven. So I microwaved the potato gems and put them on a plate with the Stras balls. And it's absolutely legendary in my family's history that Dad's best meal was Stras balls.
Stras balls. You know how I love that. Thank you, Mom's
Dad.
No,
that is like that. That is
gross.
Where invention. Nate, whoop.
It's funny for a second, and then you'd want to spew, I reckon, afterwards.
Oh, you've just got a pure stomach.
Read you this? I love this. It's anonymous and fair enough.
Okay.
39 weeks pregnant, 40 degrees. My 10-year-old daughter complained about the dinner. I had the most massive tantrum. I picked up her plate, my plate, glasses, sauce bottles, and I smashed them all on the slate floor. Hubby was hanging onto his plate saying, I'm happy with my dinner. She's never complained about dinner again. Not only do you not mess with someone that's cooked dinner, you do not mess with someone who is 39 weeks pregnant.
Oh, everything in that equation was going to end that way. We should have really had our eyes open.
So one text came in and said, you better have a solution for this. I don't.
Look, mine is possibly the only way forward. Well, I think the idea before was good, week on, week off with the kids.
Yep.
I'm post-cooking.
Don't do it.
So, like, you look at me, there's no expectation for anything nurturing to come out of me anymore.
I put a kiwi just on the side of the plate last night so I didn't feel bad.
For yourself?
No.
What did you cook?
Well, because long story, but, you know, your husband and child were going to watch the basketball. So I was like, better eat before you go. So I'm like, toasties. But then I'm like, and a little kiwi on the side. Looks green.
Look at you. Someone has just texted in saying, I just messaged my husband and declared that dinner time is now at 4 o'clock.
Yeah.
Honestly, this is the shift that we need.
Why not? I mean, who said, you know when someone says, let's go for dinner, and anything post 7 o'clock, I'm like, you've got to be joking.
Can I also say, if you get invited over, if you invite me for dinner,
oh, 4 o'clock.
I expect it cooked. I'm not going to watch you cook it.
No.
Mine's ready to go. Hey?
You want help? Like, you won't come over and be like, hey, pod the
I could come and do that, but as long... No, that's okay. But don't me come over at 7 and you're
and
just starting.
And then start. No. Oh, no, I'd leave.
No.
I'd be like, sorry.
That's so anxious.
That's crazy.
That's bad.
Because what time are you eating then? Like,
such
9?
A bad cook.
O'clock?
Yeah.
That's not cool. Absolutely not cool. Liz, oh, my God, best conversation. Thank you. I'm 68 and I can so relate to this topic discussed. Thank you. I love it. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care and we'll speak to you soon.